Hello and welcome to the AK-47 podcast. My name is Kristen Godsey, and I am the author of Everyday Utopia, What 2,000 Years of Wild Experiments Can Teach Us About the Good Life. At least that's what it's called in the United States. It's got different subtitles in the UK and in Germany, where it's also available under the name Everyday Utopia, but with different covers. So every translation has a slightly different way of presenting the book, I guess. Anyway, I have some great news. Just today, I found out that Everyday Utopia has been chosen as one of 8 finalists for season 22 of the Next Big Idea Book Club, which is a nonfiction book club, largely, I think, targeted at people in businesses and executives and things like that. So it's kind of odd that they chose my book, given that it's kind of a radical book, but I guess it was marketed in such a way that it doesn't present as quite radical when you first open it up. I thank Simon & Schuster for that. But I'm really quite happy that they decided to choose the book as one of the finalists. It's a kind of a big deal. The people who are on the finalist selection committee include Adam Grant and Susan Cain and Malcolm Gladwell. I mean, it's a pretty remarkable group of people. Daniel Pink, I think, is the other person. So in honor of that, and in honor of the fact that November 16th will be the 6-month book birthday of Everyday Utopia, and I have a little stack of books here in my office that were sent to me as author copies when the book launched on May 16th, I'm going to do a little special thing for those of you listeners who are based in the United States. So if you're based in the United States and you don't have a copy of Everyday Utopia yet and you want one, or if you want one to give away for a holiday present, I will send you a signed copy of the book through media mail. So it probably take about a week or 10 days if you are in the United States. And you can ask for one of these books. I have 15 copies to send to give away. And so if you email, if you're interested, you can email the podcast at alexandra.kollontai.podcast@gmail.com. And I will sign the book and I will dedicate it to whoever you want me to dedicate it to. I'm sorry for my international listeners because I don't have, first of all, I don't have that many copies, but also international postage is a lot more than media mail within the United States. It turns out in the United States, if you're sending books or media, it's actually quite reasonable to send because I think it goes overland or something like that. That's 15 copies. First 15 listeners who email alexandra.kollontai.podcast@gmail.com will get a free copy of Everyday Utopia. So today I'm going to go back and read a piece that I read a small selection of back in March of 2019, so pre-pandemic times. And that is Alexandra Kollontai's 1921 essay, The Labor of Women in the Evolution of the Economy. I read just like 2.5 paragraphs of this essay back in March 2019 because they were the paragraphs that were very specific to the discussion of abortion in the Soviet Union. And I, at that time, had a guest on the podcast, the poet Annie Finch, who was curating and editing a collection of fiction about abortion. And so we had a little discussion. So if you're interested in the discussion of why the Soviet Union was the first country in the world to legalize first trimester abortion, then you might want to pop back to the March 6th 2019 episode, which is also called The Labor of Women in the Evolution of the Economy. I've been thinking a lot about the argument that I put forward in Everyday Utopia. I've been doing lots of media, and so I've really had time to kind of process this kind of soundbite, which is that the way we do our family, the way we imagine the ideal of the nuclear family. So this idea of the romantic relationship being the container for parenthood, and that that's usually done between two heterosexual people who have a romantic attachment to each other, and then they raise their biological, sometimes adoptive, but they're children with exclusive biparental care in a single family home surrounded by hordes of their privately owned stuff. That model of the family, that sort of like ideal that's being held up in many of our societies, has been criticized, obviously, for a really long time. And, you know, one of the arguments that I put forward in Everyday Utopia is precisely all of the ways in which this model is just really wrong and is serving us very poorly in the 21st century for all sorts of reasons having to do with the pandemic of loneliness and isolation, income inequality, gender equality and rights, as well as climate change and climate crisis, more broadly speaking. So there's this way in which I realized, as I've been doing podcasts and writing things and reflecting on the last 6 months of the book and its life out there in the world, that this essay from Kollontai is so important. And it was really important to my thinking as I was writing the book. And because I had read just a couple of paragraphs of it, I had never actually done the whole essay on this podcast, even though it's probably, you know, kind of one of my, not one of my favorites, but it's up there. It's certainly in the top 10 of Kollontai's writings because of the way she talks about the socialization of the family and the ways in which socialism, you know, in her imagination, in her dream, of course, this is 1921, before things start to get bad, there's still this momentum around how socialist society could completely reimagine family relations to support women and to create conditions of greater egalitarianism, more broadly speaking, of people of different classes and different ethnicities and, you know, different genders, everything. Now, there are some parts of the essay that are kind of anachronistic. That's because it was written over 100 years ago. But I think that the gist of the essay is really important. And so I'm going to take this episode and the next episode to really sort of dig into this essay and talk about the ways in which Kollontai was so revolutionary in the way she was thinking about the family when she wrote this pamphlet in 1921. I am not going to read the paragraphs that deal specifically with abortion because they're actually kind of an aside in this essay. And so, like as I said, if you're interested in those paragraphs or the discussion of abortion within the Soviet context, please go back to the March 6th, 2019 episode, and you will hear our discussion of those then. Here is the first part of The Labor of Women in the Evolution of the Economy. In its search for new forms of economy and of living which meet the interests of the proletariat, the Soviet Republic has inevitably committed a number of mistakes and has a number of times had to alter and correct its line. But in the sphere of social upbringing and the protection of motherhood, the Labor Republic, from the first months of its existence, has marked out the right direction for developments to take. And in this sphere, a deep and fundamental revolution in morals and attitudes is being achieved. In this country, where private property has been abolished and where politics is dictated by the desire to raise the level of the general economy, we can now deal in our stride with problems that were insoluble under the bourgeois system. Soviet Russia has approached the question of protecting motherhood by keeping in view the solution to the basic problem of the labor republic, the development of the productive forces of the country, the raising and restoration of production. In order to carry out the job in hand, it is necessary, in the first place, to tap the tremendous forces engaged in unproductive labor and use all available resources effectively. And in the second place, to guarantee the labor republic an uninterrupted flow of fresh workers in the future, i.e., to guarantee the normal increase in population. So I just want to stop there and say, obviously, this is a moment in Russian history, Soviet history, where the country has just emerged from the First World War, as well as a very damaging civil war and a famine. And so there has been kind of widespread population decline because of the war and the, just the massive amount of casualties that have been inflicted, not to mention, you know, the famine and all of the difficulties in struggling with a new economy trying to build a future on socialist grounds. And so I think it's, you know, it is very pronatalist here. Obviously, Kollontai is recognizing that her male comrades in high positions of power are very much concerned about natural population increase. And so that's a big context to remember when we're reading this essay. All right. As soon as one adopts this point of view, the question of the emancipation of women from the burden of maternity solves itself. A labor state establishes a completely new principle. Care of the younger generation is not a private family affair, but a social state concern. Maternity is protected and provided for not only in the interest of the woman herself, but still more in the interest of the tasks before the national economy during the transition to a socialist system. It is necessary to save women from an unproductive expenditure of energy on the family so that this energy can be used efficiently in the interest of the collective. It is necessary to protect their health in order to guarantee the labor republic a flow of healthy workers in the future. In the bourgeois state, it is not possible to pose the question of maternity in this way. Class contradictions and the lack of unity between the interests of private economies and the national economy hinder this. In a labor republic, on the other hand, where the individual economies are dissolving into the general economy, and where classes are disintegrating and disappearing, such a solution to the question of maternity is demanded by life, by necessity. The labor republic sees woman first and foremost as a member of the labor force, as a unit of living labor. The function of maternity is seen as highly important, but as a supplementary task and as a task that is not a private family matter, but a social matter. Our policy on the protection of maternity and childhood, as Vera Pavlovna Lebedeva correctly notes, is based on the picture of woman in the work process, which we keep constantly before our mind's eye. Unquote. But in order to give women the possibility of participating in productive labor without violating her nature or breaking with maternity, it is necessary to take a second step. It is necessary for the collective to assume all the cares of motherhood that have weighed so heavily on women, thus recognizing that the task of bringing up children ceases to be a function of the private family and becomes a social function of the state. Maternity begins to be seen in a new light. Soviet power views maternity as a social task. Soviet power, basing itself on this principle, has outlined a number of measures to shift the burden of motherhood from the shoulders of women to those of the state. Soviet power takes responsibility for the care of the baby and the material provision of the child through the subdepartment of the protection of motherhood and childhood, headed by Comrade Vera Pavlovna, and the section of Narkompros, that is, the Commissariat of Education, which deals with social upbringing. The principle that Soviet power accepts in tackling the problem is that the mother be relieved of the cross of motherhood and be left with the smile of joy which arises from the contact between the woman and her child. Of course, this principle is far from having been realized. In practice, we lag behind our intentions. In our attempts to construct new forms of life and living, to emancipate the laboring woman from family obligations, we are constantly running up against the same obstacles, our poverty and the devastation of our economy. But a foundation has been laid. The signposts are in place. Our task is to follow the directions firmly and decisively. The labor republic does not limit itself to financial provisions for motherhood and the distribution of benefits. It aims above all to transform the conditions of life in order to make it fully possible for a woman to combine motherhood and social labor, and to preserve the baby for the republic, surrounding it with the necessary care and attention. From the very first months of the existence of the dictatorship of the proletariat in Russia, worker and peasant power has been striving to cover the country with a network of institutions for the protection of motherhood and the social upbringing of children. The mother and the child became a special object of concern in Soviet politics. During the first months of the revolution, when I held the position of People's Commissar of Social Welfare, I considered it to be my main task to chart the course that the Labor Republic should adopt in the sphere of protecting the interests of woman as a labor unit and as a mother. Okay, I'm going to stop this reading of this essay right here and reflect a little bit on it, and I'll pick up in the next episode with the remainder of the essay minus those paragraphs about abortion. So obviously, Kollontai is using the language of her comrades. Laboring units are people, right? She's talking about how important maternity is within the context of the future of Soviet Russia. Obviously, she's very concerned about the birth rate, not having enough workers, not having enough of a kind of material base to pay for all of the kind of social provisions that she wants to be able to provide. But it's exactly in this moment, as the new economic policy is getting started and they're kind of returning to some sorts of market mechanisms, that Kollontai is very worried that all of the progress that has been made in the first 4 years of the revolution is going to be, you know, regressing because the Soviet economy needs workers. And rather than focusing on women as workers, they're really thinking about women as mothers and just basically producers of babies. And there has to be a difficult choice made because the Soviet economy doesn't have the resources. It's a very poor economy at this point to invest in all the social programs that Kollontai wants in order to socialize the family, in order to destroy the private family and allow for the collectivization of parenthood. Now, Kollontai is desperately trying to make an argument that the Soviet economy just won't work. Socialism can't be built unless you deal with the family first. You have to make the family not a private institution that basically extracts unpaid labor from women in the home in order to support the economy. Women need to be part of that broader economy, and that requires the socialization of a lot of women's unpaid work. And this is not just about motherhood, right? This is also about all of the cooking and cleaning and mending and domestic work that is done privately in the home to reproduce the labor force, what is often called social reproductive labor. And so Kollontai is really saying, don't do it. Don't make the mistake of thinking that you, as a socialist government, as a socialist state, can basically extract unpaid labor from the private sphere in order to support the public sphere. If you make that same mistake in building a socialist economy, it's not going to work because you are going to essentially exploit women. And this is a republic that is supposed to be based on workers' rights for everyone. Now, of course, we know historically that Stalin does exactly what Kollontai is sort of warning that nobody should do, which is, well, let's just, it's too expensive to socialize labor. It's too expensive to socialize the family. We don't have the resources to really create good kindergartens and creches and children's homes and facilities and do the kinds of things that mothers do for free. So let's just put all that labor back into the private sphere. And then maybe at some point in the future, when our economy is better and when, you know, things are a little bit more stable economically and politically, then we can start to, you know, rethink the family. Because none of the male comrades in high positions of Bolshevik power at this point were really kind of down with what Kollontai was suggesting, even though I think in the end she was correct that if you tried to build a socialist economy on the extraction of unpaid labor in the home, it's just going to kind of replicate the bourgeois economy because it's fundamentally going to have these contradictions at the heart of it. So I think it's really important that Kollontai was clearly articulating this need to think about family structures in a way that was much more capacious than we do today. And she's building on a long history of people who thought about the private family as kind of problematic. I mean, again, especially here, the utopian socialists, but these sorts of critiques of family and insular family life, as I've said on earlier iterations of this podcast, go all the way back to Plato. Some might even say they go back to Pythagoras. Clearly, they have a long history outside of the West as well, if you think about early Cenobitic Buddhist monastic communities. But the key thing here is that Kollontai is actually in a position of political power as Commissar of Social Welfare and then later as the head of the Jeunottel. And she's actually desperately trying to articulate a vision of society where the next generation of workers, taxpayers, and consumers are not privately produced and then extracted from women's unpaid labor, that they're actually, you know, valued as part of what society does is to make children a social good, a public good. And I think it's important in one of these last paragraphs that I read that Kollontai says, look, we want to take away the not so nice bits. She's like the cross of motherhood, right? The hard parts of motherhood and just leave women the joy of contact between her and her child. So let's make it easier for women to actually enjoy motherhood, to enjoy the relationship that they have with their child and help her with all of the really hard bits. And I don't think anybody who's been a parent will, you know, think that that's a bad idea to give parents some reasonable amount of help. So I will continue with this essay in the next episode. But until then, please, you know, rate, the podcast, share it with your friends, do whatever you're supposed to do. I'm never really sure what I'm supposed to say. But if you're interested in getting a free copy of Everyday Utopia, at least you can email alexandra.kollontai.podcast@gmail.com with your address and who you want the book dedicated to. And the first 15 emails that we get will go out by media mail, which sometimes takes, I guess, 7 to 10 days, depending on where it's going in the United States. As always, thank you so much for listening and keep up the good fight.